Malibu Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Deadline to apply is Friday, October 25th at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PADHire2019.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Brown's vape ban has been temporarily halted.
It's been confirmed that a person with measles passed through the Portland International Airport, exposing others to the virus.
And in other news, the world's first all-female astronaut team completed a spacewalk.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 18th, 2019. I'm Claire Shadow.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. A person who arrived at the Portland Airport on Saturday, October 12th, has been diagnosed with measles, the Multnomah County Health Department reported on Thursday. According to the county officials, the infected person had visited countries where measles is common and had not received a measles vaccination. The person passed through the International Arrivals and Customs and Immigration areas on Saturday between 11:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Anyone in those areas during that time frame may have been exposed to the virus. County health officials recommend that anyone who may have been exposed receive a, quote, just-in-time shot of immunoglobulin by the end of the day to reduce their risk. People who are in other parts of the airport are considered to be at very low risk. Health officials say that the infected individual has not exposed anyone else to the disease since arriving in Portland. This marks the 15th case of measles in Multnomah County so far this year, the most since 1991. It brings the total number of cases in Oregon this year to 25.
An Oregon appeals court issued a ruling on Thursday temporarily halting Governor Kate Brown's ban on flavored nicotine vaping products. This ruling does not affect the ban on flavored THC vaping products. The suspension comes just 2 days after the ban went into effect. The halt on the ban comes after vape businesses and industry groups petitioned the court, stating that they would, quote, suffer severe and irreparable harm before the ban could be sufficiently reviewed by the courts, end quote. Governor Brown issued the ban on all flavored nicotine and THC products in response to the recent nationwide outbreak of vaping-related illnesses and deaths. In Oregon, there have been 9 reported illnesses and 2 deaths linked to vaping. A court in New York recently overturned a similar ban on flavored vape products, and a federal court in Massachusetts is deliberating over another. Despite the court's ruling, the Oregon Health Authority recommends that businesses, quote, voluntarily keep flavored vaping products off the shelves.
On Thursday, a bill to lower prescription drug prices sponsored by Oregon Congresswoman Susan Bonamici made it to the House floor. The bill called Lower Drug Costs Now Act would allow Medicare to negotiate with drug companies for lower prices and create an international price index to prevent companies from charging extra in the U.S. Here is what Bonamici had to say at the committee vote in support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for bringing this important legislation before the committee today, especially as we mourn the loss of our colleague, Mr. Elijah Cummings, who cared so much and worked so hard on this issue. May he rest in peace. Action to address skyrocketing prescription drug costs is long overdue, and I'm proud to be part of a committee that is tackling the issue in a meaningful way. I frequently hear from constituents about the escalating burden of paying for their medications. During our last district work period, I held 6 town hall meetings in 5 different counties across Northwest Oregon, and the issue of unaffordable drug prices came up at every single one of them. In Cornelius, Oregon, a gentleman named John held up a small tube of medication. He said he thought it was a mistake when he was asked to pay $138 out of pocket for 2 of these 30-gram tubes. Despite having robust insurance coverage, the list price for that drug was more than $250, and he was responsible for 20% copay. John wrote to me with additional details. He said, "Why is this stuff so insanely expensive?" He wondered, "Is it costly to make? Is there no generic version? Is it cutting edge, brand new, needing to make back research costs?" John did some research, and he found out that the ointment was patented back in 1968, and until 2014, it cost about $10 a tube. That's still the price in England. But in the United States, only one company sells the drug, and 5 years ago, the company raised its price about 4,000%. Now, John was fortunate that his situation was not life or death, and that he was not being forced to choose between life-saving medication and putting food on the table. Too many Americans are not so lucky. John concluded his letter by writing, "At what point does it get too outrageous? At what point is it too insane? At what point is it so bad that we actually decide to fix it? People are desperate and people are dying." I couldn't agree more than with what John said, and that is why I'm a co-sponsor of the underlying legislation and support the amendment in the nature of a substitute, which will empower the largest purchaser of prescription drugs, the federal government, to negotiate prices just like private payers, who will also benefit from these negotiations. And here's my personal story. Thank you to Representative McBeth for sharing hers. My mother's 91 years old. She's a two-time cancer survivor, and she has Alzheimer's and was recently diagnosed with irregular heartbeat. She was prescribed a medication, and I got a call from the pharmacy when they were filling the prescription. They said, "We just want you to know that the out-of-pocket cost for this prescription is more than $300 after payment by Medicare." Now, like Representative McBeth, we're able to cover that cost, but what about the families who don't have an extra $300 a month to cover the cost of life-saving medication? H.R. 3 will lower out-of-pocket expenses, particularly for seniors, and will reinvest some of the hundreds of billions in dollars in savings back into developing new therapies and improving health care for all Americans. I urge my colleagues to join me in being part of the solution.
That was Oregon Congresswoman Susan Bonamici about a new bill she has sponsored to lower prescription drug prices.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden introduced a new privacy bill in the Senate yesterday that would allow greater protection for consumer data online. If passed, the new law would give the Federal Trade Commission the power to meaningfully punish corporations who sell user data and profit from privacy breaches. It's being called the Mind Your Own Business Act, and it would allow consumers to opt out of data collection with a single click, as well as force corporations to be transparent about how data is collected, use, and who it is sold to. For years, meaningful privacy protection online has been blocked by a coalition of well-funded industries. The law would also impose harsh fines on companies and prison sentences on executives who knowingly lie to the agency about how data is used. Wyden told Motherboard, quote, "Mark Zuckerberg won't take Americans' privacy seriously unless he feels personal consequences. A slap on the wrist from the FTC won't do the job. So under my bill, he'd face jail time for lying to the government," end quote. The bill also restricts the ability of companies to make privacy a luxury option. Fees imposed by the companies must only be the amount of money by the company actually the company actually forfeits by not selling data.
Five people were rescued from a disabled sailboat Wednesday, 20 miles west of Yakina Bay in Newport. The U.S. Coast Guard responded to the crew's early morning call for help and was able to tow the boat within 2 miles from the bay, where further assistance waited. At the time of the distress call, conditions were 10 to 20 foot seas with winds up to 45 miles per hour. The call stated the crew was struggling and fearful the compromised vessel couldn't cross the bar. No one was injured during the rescue.
Fred Meyer shoppers who get cash back upon their completed transaction will now have to pay for it. The grocery store chain will be adding a 50-cent fee to cash back up to $100 and a $3.50 charge to cash back between $101 and $300. Parent company Kroger has unveiled similar fees throughout the country at other stores earlier this summer. Fred Meyer has offered the cashback feature for years and touts it as a way to expedite shoppers' personal time by saving them a trip to the ATM. Prior to October 16th, this feature was free of charge. Customer feedback, however, has been overwhelmingly negative thus far, with several complaints lodged online. Kroger's response to customer complaints, cites banks and other retailers raising ATM fees and limiting the amount of cash back availability.
An Oregon State University student's arrest last Sunday has resulted in allegations of racial profiling and the use of excessive force by Oregon State Police. 21-year-old Genesis Hansen was confronted by police for riding her bike the wrong way down a Corvallis street. Hansen, who is African-American, engaged the officers in an initially peaceful discussion disputing her wrongdoing. As a crowd of onlookers gathered, some recording the incident on their cell phones, police backup later arrived. Two officers threw Hansen to the ground and arrested her when she refused to show them her ID. Hansen was booked in the Benton County Jail for interfering with an officer and resisting arrest. Crowd response from the confrontation was of outrage, with screams of protest as the officers threw Hansen down and then pinned her. Fellow student Paige Negrete witnessed the arrest and told K2 News, quote, "It chokes me up talking about it because it was disgusting to watch," end quote. OSU officials reviewed video documents of the incident and released a statement earlier this week asking law enforcement to de-escalate situations involving students and that it has offered support services to Hansen. The statement also urged students to be compliant with the law. Oregon State Police said in a statement, quote, The matter is currently under review.
Toxic masculinity in extreme sports. That's one of the focus areas of a new documentary by Ben Jordan, which details his endeavor to become the first person to paraglide the Rockies. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade spoke with Jordan about this film, his process, and the revelations that floating alone can provide.
Hi, Benjamin. Thanks for talking with KBOO. Your documentary, The Endless Chain, chronicles your harrowing paragliding journey up the spine of the Canadian Rockies. Can you give us the synopsis?
Yeah, totally. It's been a life dream of mine to be the first person to fly a paraglider the entire length of the Canadian Rockies. And last summer, I was able to achieve that dream. It took me 52 days alone in the wilderness. I had some pretty crazy experiences, and I was able to put that into a film about the journey. And sort of as a bit of a twist, I realized some pretty dark things about myself and my motivations for getting involved in so many risky activities like I was last summer and over basically my entire career as an extreme sport athlete. Just to do with my own seeking for external affirmation of my masculinity. And I've included that in the film as well in a sort of lighthearted way that gets people to sort of take another look at some of the common stereotypes of men in extreme sport.
Well, on that note, your introduction discussion of the film will include the topic of toxic masculinity in extreme sports. What are your experiences with the subject, and why is it important for viewers of your film?
Sure. Well, I think it's important for everyone, you know, man, woman, boy, or girl, or however you would identify, to just have a sense of openness around this conversation. Because, you know, as a young boy, I'm almost 40 now. I dealt with a fair bit of bullying in school, and often, you know, questioned my own sexuality growing up, and that, you know, I didn't really feel very comfortable talking about that with my peers or my parents or anyone. And you know, much later in life, when I felt that I'd had sort of through all of that and that I was comfortable as a man in this world, that I discovered that a big part of what I have done as far as creating a career as a professional adventure athlete, whether I'm paragliding the length of the Rockies or riding a skateboard across Canada, is essentially exposing myself to extreme risk upon extreme risk, not just because I'm pushing myself, but because I'm pushing an image of myself to basically compensate for something that I don't feel I've got going on inside, which is just a sound foundation of feeling comfortable inside my own masculinity. And so for my viewers, it's a chance to ask themselves how they feel about that and how they view masculinity, and specifically inside of extreme sport, where, you know, quite a bit of brawn is shown, quite a bit of bravado, and to ask themselves maybe if there's something else that's underneath that that isn't so obvious.
So it sounds like this journey, if you will, helped affirm for you some darkness and resolution in your life. Ben, can you tell me what's next?
Well, actually, that's a great question. I found that if I talk about what it is that I'm going to do next, that it ends up creating the exact scenario that I'm trying to avoid, which is that it puts me in a situation where if I don't feel like I want to do, you know, this next journey, for instance, that will be significantly larger and perhaps a lot more risky than what I've just accomplished, I start to think about all the people that I've told and how much I don't want them to be let down and how much I don't want them to judge me for, you know, my failure or my choice to not proceed. So in order to keep my ambitions pure and to limit the risk in that respect, I actually have chosen to remain quite tight-lipped about, you know, my next adventure until, of course, it's happened. And then, you know, I continue with my job of making films and writing articles about it. So,
okay, well, good enough. Well, Benjamin, I'd like to thank you for speaking with KBOO. The Endless Chain, a documentary by Benjamin Jordan, has a viewing in Portland Saturday, October 19th at the U.S. Outdoor Store at 7 p.m. The address is 219 Southwest Broadway. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather is rain with a low of 50. Tomorrow's weather is thundershowers with a low of 47 and a high of 56. Today in history, two female NASA astronauts, Christina Koch and Jessica Meir, made history by successfully completing the first all-female spacewalk. It took all of 7 hours, 90 minutes longer than they had anticipated. As they ventured into space to repair a broken battery charger. The quote of the day is from astronaut Jessica Meir, who said, quote, "This is just us doing our job. We've been training for 6 years, so it's coming up here and doing our job. At the same time, we recognize that it is a historical achievement, and we want to give credit to the women who came before us. We have followed in their footsteps to get where we are today."
Today, two female U.S. astronauts, Christina Koch and Jessica Meir, made history as the first all-female team to successfully complete a spacewalk. Their 7-hour mission was to venture out into space and fix a battery charger. The work completed by both astronauts allowed for a now fixed charger that distributes solar power to the NASA station. This historical moment was initially planned to take place back in March, but was postponed because NASA didn't have appropriately sized suits for two female astronauts. During their mission, Koch and Meir received a phone call from President Trump congratulating the women on their historical achievement. The president, during his phone call, incorrectly stated that this was the first time a female astronaut went to space. Meir kindly corrected the president and thanked all the female astronauts, scientists, and engineers that came before her, making this day possible. Koch said about the importance of women working in space, saying as, quote, "I think it's important because of the historical nature of what we're doing and that in the past, women haven't always been at the table. It's wonderful to be contributing to human spaceflight at a time when all contributions are being accepted."
A new study conducted by the nonprofit Healthy Babies Bright Future found that 95% of baby foods contain traces of toxic metals. The study tested 168 baby food containers from 61 different brands, including Gerber, Beechnut, Earth's Best Parent, and Infamil. The study found that 1 in 4 baby foods contained arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury. Researchers warn that contaminants can alter a developing brain. Healthy Babies Bright Future is urging the FDA to enact better standards. Currently, there is no enforceable federal safety limit on heavy metals found in most of the baby foods that were tested.
Yesterday, the EPA held its only hearing on eliminating methane regulations. As a greenhouse gas, methane is 80 times more powerful in the near term than carbon dioxide. Andrea Sears has more on the story.
The EPA wants to roll back regulations for controlling methane emissions from the oil and gas industry, but clean air advocates say that's going in the wrong direction. On Thursday, in Dallas, Texas, the EPA held its only hearing on a proposal to loosen regulations designed to curb emissions of the potent greenhouse gas. Pennsylvania is the second largest producer of methane in the country, Patrice Tomchek with Moms Clean Air Force says methane is responsible for 25% of the climate change already taking place around the world and in the Commonwealth.
Families are experiencing increasing floodings and drought, and the air is degrading also because of this.
The Trump administration says rolling back methane emission regulations will save the oil and gas industry millions of dollars a year in compliance costs. The EPA takes public comments until November 25th. When oil and gas facilities leak, Tomchek says methane isn't the only pollutant that escapes. Others include chemicals like benzene and toluene that can have serious health impacts.
Things like cancer, neurological issues, blood disorders, and even adverse birth outcomes. So this is really a rule that is needed to protect the health and well-being of children, families, communities.
She adds that those who live closest to facilities like gas wells and compressor stations are at greatest risk of respiratory ailments like asthma and other health consequences. Last year, Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection released tighter emission regulations for new and modified gas and oil facilities, but Tomchek notes that with the lack of federal leadership, the state needs to do more.
Governor Wolf needs to step up and directly regulate methane for all of the hundreds and thousands of existing oil and gas facilities to protect our communities.
In April, the DEP released revised draft rules for controlling emissions from existing facilities, but critics say they don't go far enough. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Energy Secretary Rick Perry told President Trump yesterday that he plans to resign. Perry is one of the longest-serving members of the president's cabinet. He's become embroiled in the Ukraine scandal. Perry says he sought out Mr. Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani this spring at the president's direction to address Trump's worries about alleged Ukraine corruption. The White House confirmed that the president urged Perry to work with Giuliani on investigating potential corruption in Ukraine. Perry is known for his colorful remarks in his previous life as Texas governor and as a presidential candidate. He'd managed to mostly stay under the radar and out of negative headlines during his 2.5-year tenure.
Protesters interrupted the Alaskan Governor Mark Levy's first address to the Alaskan Federation of Natives by singing and beating drums. Dunleavy has had a tenuous relationship with the AFN after revoking and then reinstating funding for programs widely supported by Alaskan Natives. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy's first address to the Alaska Federation of Natives endured an interruption Thursday by protesters who sang and beat drums. Several attendees at the gathering in Fairbanks stood with raised fists, their backs to the governor. AFN co-chair Will Mayo quelled the protest, urging the audience to show respect for the annual convention's invited guest. Dunleavy is coming off a rocky start in office and is currently facing a recall challenge. He disagreed publicly with AFN over proposed budget decisions and drew sharp rebukes for budget vetoes that would have eliminated or severely hampered programs widely supported by Alaska Natives. He was forced to restore much of the funding after two subsequent special legislative sessions. Dunleavy took a more conciliatory tone in his AFN address, promising a more inclusive budget process the next time around.
We all know the budget discussions were very difficult and at times contentious this past year. I will be the first to say, as governor, I must take responsibility for my part in this process, and I will work hard to ensure the budget process goes much more smoothly this year. I will make every effort to incorporate the perspective of all Alaskans.
AFN's stated theme for this year's convention is good government, directly aimed at focusing discussions on the areas Dunleavy's vetoes targeted: public education, healthcare, Head Start, and public safety. A massive federal project designed to prevent flooding along the Missouri River is creating problems in South Dakota. Some tribal officials say the series of dams built in the 1950s have created problems for farmers on reservation land. In fact, some tribes are still struggling to find a solution. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's China Lockett has more.
BIA Route 3 runs along part of the Moreau River. When chunks of winter ice melt mix with heavy spring rainfalls, the water can rise by 20 feet and run over the gravel road. sometimes floodwater makes potholes in gravel sections, and in other places, it carves out chunks of pavement and can wear down culverts. Tracy Zephyr is the Attorney General for the Cheyenne River Tribe.
Floods that would have only occurred maybe once every 100 years, catastrophic floods, are now occurring, you know, every 10 years.
Zephyr says there are smaller floods almost every year, and she attributes some of the flooding to the Owyhee Dam. In the 1950s, the Army Corps of Engineers installed several dams in the region as part of the Missouri River Flood Control Project. The dams prevent flooding in downstream states and create hydropower. Zephyr says the Owyhee Dam and a bridge that crosses the Moreau River are causing problems.
But now, because of the short bridge and the dam and the sediment building up, when it does flood, it's leaving literally feet of sediment on what was formerly productive, you know, rangeland and farmland, and it's making it completely unusable.
Zephyr says the tribe has been telling the federal government about the problems since the dam was installed. When she urges that the Army Corps should be responsible for removing the sediment,
their response is, well, we don't have funds to do that. So if you want this done, you're going to have to go to Congress and have them appropriate us funds to be able to do that. Otherwise, we can't do it.
Zephyr says the flooding will get worse if sediment continues to collect. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe filed a lawsuit against the federal government over the matter in 2003. The government offered to settle, but the tribe has refused because it wants a solution, not a one-time financial compensation. For National Native News, I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
To hear the full story and learn about the Cheyenne River Tribe's ongoing lawsuit, visit sdpb.org. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
A new study has found that there is still hope for threatened corals, but as the climate warms, reefs need protection from threats such as overfishing and pollution. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
Reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's no longer enough on this current cast. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's no longer enough.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Warmer ocean temperatures can damage corals, and eventually even kill them. So climate change poses a grave threat to coral reefs. But a recent study suggests it's not time to despair. It's time to act.
The key thing that we found is that there is hope for coral reefs.
That's Malin Pinsky of Rutgers University. His research team modeled how corals will fare under different warming scenarios.
And what's new about what we did is that we considered the fact that corals can actually evolve a little bit, can actually evolve higher tolerance for temperatures as time goes on.
But he says that slow process will only be possible if coral ecosystems are protected from other threats, such as overfishing and pollution. So he says it's critical to create protected areas where fishing is limited and pollution is controlled. As oceans warm,
the next 50 or 100 years does look pretty grim. But what we found is that reef conservation and setting up marine protected areas can really boost corals' ability to evolve and cope with these changes. So if there's work we can do in the short term to preserve specific places, we can think about preserving a long-term future for coral reefs.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
When thinking about plastic pollution, one educator says refusing single-use plastic should come before reducing, reusing, and recycling. With more on the story, it's current cast.
Reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's no longer enough on this current cast. More than 22 million pounds of plastic ends up in the Great Lakes each year. And it's not all coming from beach-going litter bugs.
But I think so much attention has been placed on the littering problem and not enough on the fact that we have so much trash that it's getting through other avenues like trash cans that are overflowing. But I would say that that probably plays a much bigger role than we think.
Anna McCartney was with Pennsylvania Sea Grant for more than 10 years.
There's so many items that we're using, like straws and plastic water bottles and lots of other single-use containers.
So she says the saying should be, refuse, reduce, reuse, and recycle. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 18th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Jezaniah Hawthorne, and Peter Kranitz. The producer is Claire Rosciato, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
And I'm Claire Rosciato. Coming up next is Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. withdraws from Syria in a remarkable betrayal of the Kurds, is a fair characterization of corporate news media's take on recent events. The only problems being that the U.S. has not withdrawn from Syria, and a U.S. betrayal of the Kurds is not at all remarkable. If by that we mean surprising. World events can be confusing, but they're made much more so by news media coverage that insists, against all evidence, that righteousness is what guides U.S. foreign policy. We'll talk about Syria and Turkey and the Kurds.